Welcome to Seeking Alpha's Wall Street Breakfast, your daily source of market news and analysis. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Welcome to Seeking Alpha Editor's Roundtable, What Moved Markets This Week. The week ending Friday, July 2nd, a quiet week before a holiday weekend here in the U.S. Welcome to summer. Volumes were subdued. We did have the non-farm payrolls report this week, which everybody was apparently waiting for and which appears to have given the market exactly what it was looking for, coming in ahead of estimates, and the important hourly wages not increasing more than anticipated. And where we stand now at the time of this recording is that the Dow Industrials are up about 0.9% for the week. S&P is up about 1.3% week over week, and NASDAQ up 1.6% week over week. With that, I would like to introduce my co-panelists in no particular order, starting with Brad Olison, VP of News, Kim Kahn, Senior News Editor, Stephen Alfer, Managing Editor of Breaking News. I am your host and moderator, Nathaniel E. Baker, Senior Editor of Strategic Contributors here at Seeking Alpha. All right, let's start it off with Kim, as we normally do, to give us the big picture view of what moved markets this week.
Well, as you said, it was kind of lower volume and cautious trading leaning all the way up to the non-farm payrolls report. But that said, it was kind of the markets were drifting upwards, and now they're all are in the green again. As you said, the payrolls gave the markets bulls what they wanted, which was, you know, better than expected, headline print of 850,000 higher payrolls. But the one thing that maybe the caveat that people were looking at is the labor participation rate, which has been stubbornly lower around 62%. It's well off its the pace it was on in February of 2020. So getting more people into the labor market's been a big thing for the market, labor shortages and for the recovery. So that's a concern that could, you know, resonate with the Fed. So it keeps monetary policy easy, but also says that, you know, that people are adding jobs. So it was a good kind of win-win there.
Yeah. What about how things shook out with the winners and losers? Brad, what's your take there?
So given the fact that it's July 2nd, I just want to do a quick look back at our winners and losers on the half. I know we'll probably talk about that a little bit more later on in the program, but just wanted to do a quick summary before we get into the week itself. But just looking at the first half, it was definitely a year for value. Some of those names also carry a sizable debt. So between the two of those, you basically the only sector that screens for value and heavily leveraged is energy. The biggest winners so far were Marathon Oil, Diamondback Energy, which is the ticker FANG, Occidental, and also a retailer, L Brands, all kind of near or about doubling on the first half. On the loser side, no cataclysms this first half. I think the biggest loser was only down about 20% or so. And looking at some of the names like Take-Two and Paycom and Rollins, which is in pest control, and Ball, which is kind of, I don't want to call it boring, but they do a little the packaging of cans and bottles. All of those names were among the worst performers, but that's because they were doing extremely well last year. The momentum strategy over the first half was one of the worst performing strategies. That basically involves buying all the stocks that have done well over the prior 12-month period. And so it just looked like some of these names lost a little bit of steam into the first half. But moving on specifically to this last week, you know, as we mentioned, it's gave the bulls what they wanted. It was a bit of a risk-on week, so tech and growth names led, while some of the rate-sensitive and more defensive stocks were struggling. Specifically in the losers area, where there were some refiners, basically just related to some fundamentals in gasoline and the crack spreads, like Valero and Phillips. But also the interesting part was cruise lines. We haven't talked about those in quite some time. Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Cruise, and Carnival Cruise, all of those were among the worst performers this week. That followed Carnival Cruise Lines earnings towards the end of last week. Some of that week weakness carried into the early part of this week. They also announced an equity offering. And then you can't forget the fact that COVID reared its ugly head on a Royal Caribbean cruise line just in recent days. So that kind of weighed on the space. And on the winners, almost entirely M&A related. So whether it was Etsy, which bought a Brazilian crafts design, I believe, company for about $200 million, or the chip makers. So AMD got some approvals for its Xilinx deal. NVIDIA got some broad industry support for its ARM acquisition. And they also, you know, they also didn't hurt that the gorilla in the space, Intel, had a bit of a chip delay. So whether it's M&A, chips, or cruises, you know, you could take your pick.
Yeah. You mentioned earnings, and we did have some of that this week. What else were you looking at, Stephen, on the corporate news side of things?
We haven't talked about it in a couple of weeks, so I wanted to get back to it. And that, a story that's certainly being talked about, but not nearly enough, in my opinion, is Bitcoin had a full-fledged state-level attack to try to destroy it in June by China. This wasn't some bureaucrat in Sichuan province deciding that, you know, the payoffs weren't enough from the Bitcoin miners. This was a well-organized plan. They shut down pretty much nearly all the Bitcoin mining in the country in the last 2 weeks in June. That was the culmination of some other things that the country had done. The hash rate plunged, the price of Bitcoin plunged, and I believe that Beijing was trying to start kind of this reflexive thing where the hash rate would continue to go down, the price would continue to go down, the hash rate would go down more, the price would continue to go down, and Bitcoin, it wouldn't go to zero, but end up, you know, somewhere, you know, a 90% crash, say, from current levels. It did go from about 43,000 to 28,000 in about a week. And I, you know, somehow held that level and bounced from there. I think if it had gone much lower, I think that whole reflexive cycle would have been set in place, and Bitcoin easily could have been, you know, not wiped off the face of the earth, but just going back to just kind of this cultish kind of ownership. Institutions would have had to sell their holdings. Would an insurance company kind of hold Bitcoin if there's like the hash rate goes way down and there's a 51% attack, you know, no insurance company is ever going to own Bitcoin again, that kind of thing. So somehow it survived it. Now the bulls are kind of taking a victory lap here, saying, hey, we survived this state level attack. It's nothing but up. I think the troubles are not out of the way for Bitcoin. I think there'll be China and other countries probably have more bullets to fire against that. And I expect we'll see that in coming, you know, weeks, months, years.
Not to mention their own digital competitors.
Right. Yeah. Who knows why China was doing it? They certainly could care less about whether Bitcoin is mined with clean energy or not. They have their own competing currency. And Bitcoin also allows folks to kind of do things outside of the traditional financial system, which obviously if you're kind of this the Chinese Communist Party isn't too pleased with.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. I mean, I think that might have a lot to do with it. They've periodically cracked down on cryptos and on allowing people to withdraw money and exchange the RMB for other currencies. And so this might just be part of that in their quest.
Yeah, they have done it. They've done many times over the years, right? Everybody kind of poo-pooed it at the start. Well, China's banned Bitcoin, you know, 30 times over the last 7 years. This is just another, this was an actual full-fledged attack to shut down all the miners like that. You know, that just can't be done by like kind of one guy sitting in Beijing. That has to be coordinated amongst all the governments, all the regional governments. And so really quite remarkable move, I think.
Well, it also takes, I mean, even though they survived, it takes maybe the blue sky scenario for pricing might be out of the picture if China is no longer involved.
Yeah.
It'll still be supported for sure.
So is Bitcoin overpriced now? We're looking at 33,600 today. It's up 1.3%. Doesn't seem like it's really trading like there is a big apocalypse coming right now.
Yeah, I think the apocalypse came when it went down to 28,000. I think it somehow held that level. But yeah, it could take years for all that mining power to come back online in other countries. You just can't like ship the mining machine on eBay to. You know, Steve Alford and Collegeville aren't going to plug it in and start working again. That's just not the way it works. These things take a long time to come back online. And you know, it was a big blow. And I'm sure they have more bullets in their gun. And a really interesting story.
All right, let's move on to the next segment of the show where we discuss our favorite stories or Seeking Alpha articles or other items that we have seen or followed or contributed to in the previous week, starting with Kim.
Well, AMC popped up on my screen today, and I hadn't been thinking about it for a little while. Iceberg Research came out with a short call on it. They said they're shorting the stock. It's just a short tweet with their explanation saying the fundamentals are clear. And, you know, after weeks of losses on options, they think that the AMC ape trade is losing steam, basically. If you're looking at fundamentals, actually, AMC came out with a big press release this week at the start of the week saying, you know, that we had 2 million people in our theaters for, you know, over the Fast and Furious weekend, and, you know, theaters are back. But if you dig into those and you're looking from previous, you know, years in 2018, 2019, that, you know, there are, you know, on a pace for about 5 million visitors, almost 4.9 million visitors a week. So they're about 60% off that pace still. And even in, like, you know, 2019, they had that many and they lost money. So, you know, it's obviously the fundamental case is there. What's interesting to see is whether this is seen as another gauntlet laid down by a short seller to the, Wall Street Bets crowd. You know, what happened with Citron Research and GameStop, where actually Citron got out of the, you know, shorting game, the short call game. And, we'll see if they kind of, I'll be interested to see if AMC, it popped down 11% right after the news came out. It's paired those losses. I'll be interested to see, you know, if it could close today in the green and see if the retail crowd can get their, you know, game on again.
Well, they're going to have to get on it because it's down 9% here as we record this, and we have about 3.5 hours of trading left. So stranger things have happened, but we'll have to see. Maybe the reaction will come next week after the holiday weekend. Maybe all these guys are at the beach already.
Yeah.
Or in their basements or wherever it is that they go. All right. How about Brad?
I'm going to use COVID to kind of shoehorn into a forward-looking outlook. And just, you know, you're going to have to bear with me here. We're going to go through quite a couple rounds of mental gymnastics to get there, but we will. J&J, story of the weekend. From one of our editors, J&J COVID-19 vaccine and risks from the Delta variant. Experts are already taking their booster shots. I thought this was rather interesting. I think we're all concerned with some of the countries that are seeing spikes in the Delta variant. The U.S. it keeps cropping up as a major, portion of the new cases. Obviously, the U.S. is in a much different situation than the rest of the world with a higher vaccinated population. But I guess that kind of led one of the more famous analysts on the street, Marko Kalinowicz at JP Morgan, to kind of dismiss that Delta variant. So the experts are taking the booster shots from all these mRNA vaccines, but the sell side's dismissing it as a risk to the market. Instead, Marco actually says that he's forecasting a rising yield environment for the rest of the year with value to outperform again. I guess basically on the assumption that over the past year, growth stocks tended to outperform during lockdowns, and that he doesn't really see the likelihood of any lockdowns persisting in the next few months, at least when it comes to some of the major developed markets. So values already outperformed for most of the year. He expects that to continue into the next few months, along with rising yields, which tended to have, and at least in the past couple months, hurt some of these high-flying tech names. As far as the other sell-side sentiment is concerned, so an interesting note out of Bank of America talking about their sell-side indicator, basically kind of a collection of thoughts from the street. They say that it's fallen for the first time in 10 months. Basically, the street's getting a little wary of this, the new highs in the S&P, but it's still elevated, right? There's still, even though it's downticked, it's still very, very high, to the point that Bank of America itself says that the bullishness on the street is a contrarian signal to sell. I don't know if that's the pot calling the kettle black or not, but nevertheless, it was kind of an interesting story. They still say that tepid returns are expected in the market for the rest of the year. And I think you kind of have to look at some of the breadth in the market for some validation there, right? Fewer stocks have been hitting new highs in the S&P recently. And that seems to mean that some of the momentum is running out. And lastly, Goldman has some interesting reasons to be bullish. The U.S. companies authorized a near record amount of share buybacks over the past few weeks with earnings announcements, et cetera. And today marks the strongest seasonality, the 2 weeks of seasonality that we'll see in the market, you know, for the year, the first 2 weeks of July.
So this is historically the best 2 weeks for the market?
Right. You take any 2 week span, July, the first 2 weeks of July tend to be it.
Since when, do you know?
Not sure. At least 20, 30 years.
Interesting.
Wow.
Now, they did say that the last 2 weeks of June are the worst, and we hit how many record highs during that period?
Yeah, a bunch. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Stephen has something going on in the background, but hopefully
I'm
not.
I'm sorry about that, guys.
No, it's fine. But what are your favorite story this week?
Just the H1 wrap-ups by a lot of the editors on the news team. No surprise that the reopening plays led. There are a lot of them are coming from very low bases, so I wouldn't make too much of it. And as Brad alluded to, you know, the question for H2 is COVID kind of coming back in some variant or some other form, and is that going to, you know, kind of reverse the trend where the work from home stocks, you know, are the big winners in H2. And an item Kim did about targets for H1 and for the full year, I was really interested by the interest rates. Again, what's fascinating to me is long-term interest rates are kind of not confirming everything that we're told about what's happening, about the economy is booming, inflation is rising, the stock market's gangbusters, yet the long-term yield keeps dropping. And I was really interested in Kim's outlook where the 10-year is about 144 as we speak. Nobody on the street is predicting a decline in the 10-year yield. The range is roughly from 1.5% to 2%. So either a modest rise in yields in H2 to a sizable rise in yields in H2. But as far as I can tell, no street strategists are predicting a declining long-term yield in H2. So I'd be really interested to see in the market reaction if, as usual, the interest rate outlook is wrong.
Everyone on the same side of the boat,
right?
You know what happens. So
I really can't remember the last time, maybe since like 2010, that the outlook was for lower yields 6 months or a year down the road. The continued economic boom, the inflation. The next Fed rate hike cycle was always right around the corner. Interest rates are always headed higher. No one's ever predicting, except for, you know, a few kind of iconoclastic guys, like we talked about Hoisington Investment Management. Pretty much the totality of street analysts always see yields rising 6 months down the road.
I saw a tweet about this. I have to try and dig it out about rules of being a sell side economist. And one of them was like, you know, never make a call to the market or the, you know, rates are going to fall because you'll be singled out and then vilified. But if you're wrong, you'll be wrong with everybody and everybody forget about it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I was going to say maybe never make a call, you know, have a bunch of commentary around the edges and say that on the one hand, rates could go up. On the other hand, they could go down. There you go. That's 90% of all sell side economists right there, pretty much.
Master the phrase that said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you have to question, why would investors buy bonds at this point? I mean, if you have inflation ticking up, you have the economy in good shape, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. I mean,
well, that's the question, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, we can't ignore the Fed, right? The Fed is buying lots and lots of treasuries. And so when that tapering starts to wane, we'll see. I think there were some auctions in which they were mass majority of the buyers. So there's still some of that support. And so we'll see when that punch bowl is taken away. It's obviously helpful for the equities, helpful for the wealth effect. And I think that's going to help bolster growth. But also something to consider is, even though the Fed is looking in the short term, potentially, or in the next 2 years to raise rates, that is a potentially disinflationary event. And so you will kind of have a dampening of the growth outlook over time. So it's almost kind of a self-defeating. We want this normalization. We want rates to rise, but then that's going to hurt the economic growth cycle. And so then your yields will fall. So, you know, you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. And it also helps, you know, you can use that argument to speak out of both sides of your mouth, like all the analysts we've talked about.
Yeah. All right. And for me, favorite stories here, I'm going to the space race, Virgin Galactic saying that by July 11th, or on July 11th, I guess they're going to launch Was it a manned spacecraft? I don't completely understand why all these billionaires are rushing to get into space, but if they all want to go to space so badly, I think we should just let them and maybe let them stay up there for a little while and see how they like it. Because yeah, it's just one of these weird things that, and I still don't understand the business case for this, other than if you're, I mean, I guess there are a lot of billionaires who want to go to space, but I don't understand why they want to go to space. But
well, you used to be able to spend $20 million to hitch a ride on a Russian rocket.
Is that right? That was all cooked, 20 million?
I think it was all 20 million, yeah.
Wow.
And they would send you up to the space station.
Nice.
But I think they pulled that program, so now we're going to get more creative.
Yeah, I mean, anyway, I can never, yeah, whatever. That's just signs of excess, signs of vast discrepancies of wealth inequality and all these other things.
Well, it's helpful for the shares.
The possibilities are endless, actually. I mean, I get it now. It's
the final frontier.
Yeah, I mean, if you could cut the trip from New York to Tokyo, from whatever that takes, you know, 18 hours to 2 hours via space, you know, that's...
Sure. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that.
And that's a very minor part of what it could be. But yeah, right now it's just kind of a billionaire's, like the America's Cup, you know?
Right. Yeah. Okay, good stuff. Thank you all for staying with us here, for watching us. And if you're listening, please do check out the video. It's really worth checking out. Our video team does an excellent job. You can see us all here in our living rooms or offices, which are not at all digitally enhanced. And a bunch of other cool stuff flying across the screen for you. Again, thanks to the video team. Check that out at seekingalpha.com/videos. Thank you for watching or listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next week. Have a safe holiday weekend and look forward to speaking to you next week. Bye.
That concludes today's Wall Street Breakfast. Thank you for listening. For the best investment analysis and news on the web, go to seekingalpha.com. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can sign up for our other podcasts, Behind the Idea, Essay for FAs, Let's Talk ETFs, the Cannabis Investing Podcast, and Marketplace Roundtable on those platforms as well. Have a great day.